a cute crew. All right, there you go. Head with them. Yeah, there we are. Everybody likes something new, don't they? I like new things. Do you like new things? I like whenever, now I admit I do have those things that I kind of hold on to perhaps a little longer. Guys, just a quick survey. How many of you have that shirt that you love, that your wife would love to be rid of? Yeah? I hear you. There are, you know, those are the things that suddenly sneak down to the basement and disappear. And I have to occasionally just travel down to the basement and look in the stack of clothes to see what accidentally got placed down there. Because I'm certain that it was by accident. It wasn't, you know, on purpose that Susan put my clothing downstairs. That can't be possible. But, you know, there's new, and then there's new. Like, for instance, that new car smell. You know that smell that I'm talking about? That smell whenever you get into a new car and it has that particular little smell to it. And in fact, it's, you know, people know that new car smell so much that they actually, have you noticed that they put it on like a little card that you can hang in your car after the new car smell has faded? It doesn't smell at all like a new car. It smells like a piece of cardboard with some sort of scent on it, but it's not new car. Because, you know, new car smell fades. It doesn't stay, so it goes away. But then, of course, there's a different level of new. Like the first time you hold a new baby. Or you're standing at the front and the pastor says, "I now pronounce you man and wife." Now that's a whole different level of new. You know that that's going to change things forever. That's not just like a new car that's going to fade very quickly, that new car smell. But, you know, because we live in a broken world, even those kind of new things sometimes experience problems. Even where things go great, eventually we experience loss. We experience things that hurt us deeply in relationships, and there's heartache, sickness. There are things that happen along the way that even when it's the kind of new that is a dramatic change in our lives, we know that those changes are most often not forever kind of changes. But then there's a different kind of new. There's the new that whenever God starts making things new, we shift to an entirely different level. This time, what is recreated, what is created by Him, is permanent. This is the kind of new that remains new for all of eternity. And we're in the book of Revelation and we're studying this time in history where, on the one hand, all of time as we know it, as we talked about last week, time comes to an end. The way in which we think about the time, the way in which we experience time comes to an end. It draws to an end. But then God says, "I'm going to make all things new." And this kind of new is not like that car that you get that after a few months the smell fades and the newness of it fades. It's not even like the incredible experience of having a newborn baby in your arms. This is a kind of new that is new for all of eternity. So I want us to look at this morning Revelation chapter 21. It's the next section in these last couple of chapters that we're studying over the month of April. And so I want us to look at Revelation chapter 21, verses 1 through 8, and see what God is talking about whenever He says that He will restore heaven and earth and make all things new. What kind of situation are we talking about? So Revelation 21, verses 1 through 8 says, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people. And God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away." And he who was seated on the throne said, "Behold, I am making all things new." Also he said, "Write this down, for the words are trustworthy and true." And he said to me, "It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give from the spring of the water of life without payment. The one who conquers will have this heritage, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. But as for the cowardly, the faithless, the detestable, as for murderers, the sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars, their portion will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is the second death." All right, so last week we talked about the judgment. We talked about what happened whenever time stops and we move into this next part of eternity, whenever there is the judgment. And last week we talked about what would happen at the judgment as Christ is sitting on the throne, as God is sitting on the throne, and every single human being who has ever existed will go through that judgment time and what that looked like. But now the question is, as we continue to move forward, so what happens after that? What is it that happens after the judgment? What is it that we can anticipate, we can expect? Now, I'm going to go ahead at the very beginning and just simply say, nobody knows for sure. Now, I mean, to just be honest, I think we can take Scripture and we can look and we can explore and we can make some, I think, good, educated guesses about what that's going to look like. But the only way we will know 100% is when we get there. So this morning, I want us to look at what Scripture is saying and say, okay, what is John trying to communicate to us in this form of literature that we know as apocalyptic literature, which uses pictures? The problem is that John is using pictures for things no human eye has ever seen. He's using pictures for things that will come in the future, will exist in all eternity, but are so huge and so incredible that to describe it takes words that John doesn't have. And so he's using these pictures, this apocalyptic kind of language to say, well, it's like, and he draws pictures, which I think is a wonderful way of doing it. We live in a time in which we use a lot of pictures for communication. Think Instagram. So basically, yes, Revelation is the Instagram of the Bible. Well, sort of, but not really. But it does use pictures. And so this language that John is using is a language that goes beyond what words can express. And so understand that as we go into this and we begin to explore and to look at what will happen after the judgment, we have to say that simply these are pictures that we think will in some way be similar to what we experience. But whatever we experience will be so much greater than what we can possibly imagine. Now, to those who have accepted the gift of life, remember that God, what we cannot do, we talked about this last week, what we cannot do, what we cannot achieve, God achieves for us in terms of the ability to come into his kingdom. So life in the kingdom, this is where we're going to spend the majority of our time for the next 3 weeks, is what is it going to look like in forever, in eternity, for those who have come into relationship with Christ. Now, it's important to remember that Revelation is the counterpart to Genesis. In fact, he talks about, in this passage, John says that God is saying that I am the Alpha and the Omega. That is, I am the first and I am the last. I am the beginning and I am the end. And so when we look at the book of Revelation, one of the things we have to understand is that what Revelation is doing is saying, remember Genesis, remember creation, remember how everything was designed to be. That is going to be reestablished, restored, and brought back in Revelation. Everything as God had intended it in the beginning will be brought back to restoration in the end. And so it's important to keep those things in mind as we go through this passage. So, what will this new life look like? So the first thing that coming drawing from Revelation from Genesis, one of the things that we learn in Revelation is that God steps in again as creator. He makes all things new. That's a wonderful statement. God is the most incredible creator ever in all of eternity. You look at the earth this week, by the way, if you get the chance to just go through and look at some of the pictures and some of the videos that are done on tourist websites for Germany, you live in a beautiful country. It is fabulous. And looking at some of these videos, they're just amazing to see the wonderful beauty of nature and of what's being created and of the different areas of Germany. It's just marvelous and wonderful. It will pale in comparison to what we have in eternity. And God steps in again as creator. And so he says, I am creating a new heaven, a new earth, and a new Jerusalem. Three things that he says he's creating new. Now, we're going to cover the last one of those, the new Jerusalem. We'll talk about next week. But today I want us to talk about what does it mean that God is creating a new heaven and a new earth. Now we get some hints at this. This promise of a new heaven, a new earth, and a new Jerusalem actually comes from Isaiah chapter 65. And then here in Revelation we have, then I saw this new heaven and new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was the sea was no more. Now, you read that and you think, I have no earthly idea what that means. But I want us to start with the end. And then we'll talk about creating a new heaven and a new earth. But what does John mean whenever he says the sea had passed, there was no more sea? Now, as you can imagine, in all of Revelation, there are so many different interpretations. One person I saw even said that this means that we will no longer be a water-based life form. I don't think that's what that means. How many of you like the water? How many of you love going to the ocean and to the beach and that kind of thing? If there is no more water, are you going to be disappointed? Yeah, me too. I mean, I like fish. So water is pretty important. I don't think that's what John is saying. I don't think that's what God is saying through John. What I think he is saying is, think about John is isolated on an island. He's banished. He has been banished to an island. And in those days, the sea was a point of separation. Now, you could sail some of the seas, but oftentimes those who sailed the seas didn't survive the journey. It was dangerous. It was hard, and there were limits to the ability to travel and to get connected to other people. If someone basically, if they lived across the sea, it wasn't so long ago that if you said someone lives across the sea, you meant they were not accessible. You were separated from them, and that separation could not be overcome. There was a separation that was permanent. And in fact, in Revelation chapter 4, if you read Revelation chapter 4, it describes God sitting on his throne, and John is viewing it from a distance, and he says, and there is a sea like glass that separates us. So I think whenever John is writing about, and the sea is no more, one of the things that he is talking about is there is no more separation. There's no more separation between God and man. There is no more separation between man and man. That in this new heaven and this new earth, one of the characteristics of that is simply that there is no more separation. Now, I do not know how this is going to happen. I'm sorry. I wish I knew how we would be connected with a person or be able to communicate with a person on the other side of a new earth. I wish I knew. I don't know if we beam over or what happens, but there is, I think what he's trying to communicate is that which separates us, these distances which keep us from communicating, the things that happen that keep us separated. The situations in life, the pains, the hurts, the sorrows, the misunderstandings, all of those things that keep us separated from one another and from God are sins. They do not exist any longer. We will be unified. We'll be together in a way that is unique. It's new. It is something that only the Creator God could come up with. And so when he says this new heaven and this new earth, he says there will be no sea. One of the things that I think he's talking about is that there will no longer be the separation between God and man and his fellow man, her fellow person, man, woman, that we will be together. And so I think that's part of what it's saying. But also in Revelation, one of the things that happens in the seas whenever you look through Revelation is that is the source of all of the enemies. In Revelation, all of the enemies of God come forth from the sea. They come forth from the sea. We'll talk about this more next year. I'm sorry, you'll have to wait. But next year, one of the things, we're going to cover the middle part of Revelation next year. And one of the things that we'll see is that all of these enemies of God come forth from the sea. And so one of the things that I think in this new creation, there are no more enemies. What an incredible thing. We live in a day in which every place we seem to turn, there's another enemy, right? If it's not an external enemy, if it's not somewhere, someplace that things have broken down and we see enemies, enmity between nations, between peoples, between individuals, if it's not that, we sometimes feel at enmity with ourselves. We struggle, we fight, we desire to do something but do the opposite. We're at enmity even with ourselves. And in this new creation, this new heaven, this new earth, there will be no more enemies. Not only will there not be any separation, but there will not be any enemies. There will be no one that we're fighting against. There will be no more torn feelings that we have within ourselves because we desire to do something and yet we don't. Or we desire not to do something, but we do. We feel that enmity in ourselves as well. And in this new heaven and new earth, there will be no more sea. There will be no more separation. There will be no more enemies. Those battles are over. There will be a new heaven and a new earth. Now, most of us think, how many of you have ever seen some picture of heaven involving a cloud and some sort of small human-like creature playing a harp, usually with wings? I don't like those because that's not a representation of what heaven is like. And yet sometimes we think, most of the time whenever we talk about eternity, we talk about going to heaven. And when you ask, what does it look like in heaven? Well, we'll become like angels. No, we will not. We will not. And in fact, actually, the whole idea of going to heaven for eternity, according to Revelation, is wrong. Just let that sink in for a minute. Because that's not what it says. That's not how it's described in this passage. What is described is that God will take a new step of creation and restoration, removing what has kept heaven, that is, his kingdom, apart from the earth, which is where his creation lives, that all that separates those two will somehow be taken away, that he will create a new heaven and a new earth that somehow seem to be joined together. I don't know. I know you're wondering, how is that going to happen? What is that going to look like? I don't know. But that's what's described. And if anybody tells you that they know how this is going to look, they're simply not telling you the truth. Because we don't know. It's indescribable. But we get glimpses of what God is doing, and these glimpses are amazing. Look at verse 3. It says, "And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God.'" Now, I think this is a glimpse of that time whenever the seas, that which separate us from God and each other, have been removed. And so we are now joined together in the dwelling place of God. Now, think back to Genesis. Where was the dwelling place of God? With man in the garden. God walked with man in the garden. There was no separation. And in Revelation, what we have is the restoration of what we saw in Genesis. And so God walks again with his people. There's no separation. We are again dwelling in the same place. So God has this amazing task ahead of him that I have no idea how he's going to accomplish it. That's why he's God. And he is going to create a new heaven and a new earth that are somehow bound together where there is no separation. We're together. Secondly, God will walk with his children as he did in the garden. Now, this is a fellowship that is so much greater than the shadows. If you're a follower of Christ, you know what it means to walk with God. You pray, you listen, you hear his voice, you experience God's leading and guidance. And it's all shadows, isn't it? Don't you wish that you could just hear God's voice one single time? It's like, if you would ever just answer me verbally, this would be the time, God. This is such an important, incredibly important decision. I need just a whisper, something. Now, that doesn't mean we don't experience God. It doesn't mean that we don't hear him. But it's shadows. It's shadows. And in this time, just as it was in the beginning, God will walk with his people. And then listen to this, verse 4. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. And death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. Now, you don't have to say anything, but have you been in mourning this week? Have you cried? Have you expressed frustration? Have you hurt? There will come a day, if we are followers of Christ, if we have that relationship with him, when it will become everything. Right now we have a long-distance relationship. But the day will come when that separation is taken away. And we will walk with him, and he will wipe our tears. And there will be no more death, no more mourning, no more crying or pain. And then look at verse 5 and 6, and it says, "And he who was seated on the throne said, 'Behold, I am making all things new.' Also he said, 'Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true.' And he said to me, 'It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give from the spring of the water of life without payment.'" Now, when God says it's done, when did you hear that before? We've heard that before Revelation, didn't we? We hear it from the cross. As Jesus says, it is finished. It is done. There's nothing else. There is nothing we need for our relationship to God except our relationship to Him. In the cross, Jesus did everything. There's nothing else we need to add. There's nothing else we can add. We can't bring anything to that to make it possible for us to have a relationship with Christ. We have to trust that when He says it is finished, it is finished. That's all. And yet, when He comes to the end of time and God says, it's done. It's finished. That is the fulfillment of everything that happens from Genesis all the way through to the end of time. And it is finished. What I started in the garden has been brought to fulfillment and restoration in Revelation. It is done. I am the beginning and I am the end. And then He says, to the thirsty, I will give the water of life without payment. I love that because, again, if you remember a conversation that Jesus has with the woman at the well, and He says, she starts trying to argue with Him about religion, and He says, woman, what you really need is you need that water of life. You need the water that no one can ever buy, but that is offered freely. See, the thing is when we get to this point, whenever we are standing and time has stopped and the judgment has already taken place, what we will recognize is that we have absolutely nothing that we bring that makes us worthy. The only thing we can ever say is, I drank of the water of life. The one who said, it is done, it is finished, I accepted His offer of that water, of salvation, that water of eternal life. That's all we have to offer. And that's all that will put us in this place. And here's the great thing. It's enough. It's enough. Most of us in this room, at some point, have struggled to think we have done enough to make ourselves acceptable to God. All of us. I would say, if you've had that desire to live for God, you want to live in relationship with Him, all of us have struggled with, well, okay, so how much is enough? What do I have to do to make Him happy? And ultimately, what He is saying is, all that it comes down to, the whole thing comes down to, do you trust me enough to give me your life? On the one hand, it costs you nothing. Because Jesus literally did it all for us. On the other hand, it costs you everything. Because whenever we come to Him with empty hands and we say, now you fill it. We ask to be recreated. We ask to be put back, restored. That He would say about us, it's done. She has had that water of life that I give. And it's enough. We bring nothing, but we give Him everything. And that points us to the last point, and that is, the struggle is worth it. Verses 7 and 8 say, the one who conquers will have this heritage. Now let's stop right there. The one who conquers. Have you ever felt like life is a struggle? Have you ever felt like just getting through the day is a struggle? That committing our lives to Christ, it's a struggle. To living as a follower of Christ, it's a struggle. To doing what He desires for us to do, to understand what that means, to know what it means, and then to live in such a way that we are obedient in living that way, that it's a struggle. Well, here's the thing. You're right. You're right. Scripture is clear that living as a follower of Christ is not for the weak of heart. And when we come to these verses and it says, to the one who conquers, it's not because we bring anything to the picture in terms of coming into relationship with God. We bring absolutely nothing other than a willingness to accept that gift. But let me tell you, from that point, we are in a battle. We are in a battle. And one of two things will either happen in that battle. One, we will either fight or we will give up. We will either fight or we will give up. We'll simply say, you know what? It's just too hard. I don't want to put myself in that place. I don't want to put myself in the place of having to go through that. I don't want to put myself into the place of having to say that. I don't want to put myself into that struggle. And we give up. We just simply adopt the things of the world. Or we will take every single day and say, I'll do my very best to be obedient today. Today. Can't tell you what tomorrow's going to bring, but today I will seek to be obedient. And he says, in verse 7, he says, the one who conquers, the one who conquers, the one who lives into the calling that God has given us will have this heritage. What heritage is that? Well, all that he's given us that picture of. All that he's given us that picture of. The seas are gone. That there is that relationship, that intimacy with God. Everything that he has pointed to is our heritage for conquering. It is our heritage for living as his people. For being the children that he has called us to be. And it goes on and it says, and I will be his God and he will be my son. For all eternity. You wonder what you're going to do for all eternity? Now we'll continue. The next 2 weeks we're going to talk about what kind of life is it going to be like in an eternity. In this new heaven and new earth. So we're not going to get into it a lot today. But what does it mean? You know, we sometimes have this. I've even heard people say, it's going to be awfully boring in heaven. I'm not sure. I really like doing this, 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 and this. Are we going to do that in heaven? Well, I can guarantee you, you will not be bored for eternity. He will be our God, and we will be his children. And God knows how to give good gifts to his children. And then verse 8 says, but as for the cowardly, the faithless, the detestable, as for murderers, the sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars, their portion will be in that lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is the second death. Now, we talked last week about the lake of fire. I found it interesting today that in comparing the ones who conquers, the one who conquers, who is willing to do battle, doesn't mean you win every battle, by the way, but you're willing to go to battle. You have that courage. Compared to that, next comes, but as for the cowardly. I thought about that a lot this week, about what does that mean? Because see, I think there are two very clear choices. We either live a courageous life or a cowardly life. We either live a courageous life, a life in which we seek to live out the calling that we have. And I will tell you that that takes courage. It will not simply happen. It takes courage. But the alternative is a cowardly life. to the cowardly. Never seen that listed in a list of what it means to, for, you know, we talk about sins, we talk about those ways in which we rebel against God, and only here do I ever read cowardly. And yet I think, honestly, it's probably the best descriptor of what it means to live in a way that does not please God. Because quite honestly, it is a cowardly way. It is a way in which you simply give yourself over to the natural. You give yourself over to those things, to those ways in which we're pulled, those ways in which we desire to live in rebellion. You simply say, okay, there is no battle. It is saying, I'm not going to do battle. I'm going to live in the way I want to live. I'm going to live in the way that I desire. I'm going to live and do that. It cost me too much to do the other, and so I choose to live for myself. Close with this. I sometimes think we are a lot like kids at a kermis. You know what a kermis is? A circus, a fair, you know, one of those kind of things. And you see them, if you go by, if you drive on 66 from Wiesbaden, from like Nordenstadt out towards Eltville, on the right-hand side a lot of times there's a fairground, and there is a fair out there. Seems like three or four times a year there is a fair set up there with the wheels and all the midway and the games and all of that. Now, have you ever been to one of those? Everybody know what I'm talking about. Have you played the games? You know, the games that they set up where you have to shoot the gun and you squirt water and you pop a balloon or you knock down something and everything. And if you win a prize, it's sometimes it's like, have you seen these ginormous stuffed animals that they give away at these things? They give away all these kinds of prizes. And every kid who goes out there, and about 87% of us adults, want one of those prizes. They look so great. They look so fun. Until you get one. And then you discover that, shall we say, the quality of workmanship that has gone into that is the reason that they are offered as prizes at a fair like that. They fall apart, you know. You get the teddy bear, the big stuffed teddy bear, and you say, oh, what a cute teddy bear, and the arm falls off. They're just pieces of bad workmanship. And yet we go through life choosing that. We go through life choosing the cheap stuff. We pursue with all of our hearts, we pursue the stuff that is a substitute for what God wants to give us. It is a cheap knockoff that Satan gives and says, chase this, it'll be great, you'll love it. Do this, make sure you have this in life. And we chase those things, and whenever we get it, we discover that it doesn't fulfill us. That it's just simply a cheap substitute for the reality that God desires that we have. I love that it says, the one who conquers have this incredible heritage. Your heritage awaits you. Would you pray with me, please? Father,